So, good evening, everyone. So, in considering what I might talk about this evening, I thought the only thing I was inspired to talk about was to talk about retreats, the experience of going on meditation retreats. So, if that's agreeable with all of you, we could do that. I could do that, or we could just do questions this evening, or both. But it's always kind of awkward for me to suggest a topic and then say, well, do you have anything else in mind? But so, and I was kind of prompted to give this talk because, or talk about this topic, because a week or two ago, someone suggested that there are a lot of new people who come to our sitting group who've never been on retreat, and they kind of would like to kind of know a little bit what retreat is about and the experience and to know about it as a possibility. And it's true that I seldom talk about retreats, even though they're very central to our particular tradition of Buddhism. And I suppose someone could come for weeks or months or years to our sitting group here in Palo Alto and you know, never even occurred to them that going on a meditation retreat is an interesting thing to do. And in a sense, the particular tradition of Buddhist meditation that I teach was originally designed to be a retreat practice. It was really originally meant for people who weren't doing intensive retreat, sometimes months at a time, and not so much for everyday life. Even though now it's been applied, you know, it's something people do in everyday life as a daily meditation practice, and that's something you apply in your work and your relationships with people or whatever you're doing. But that's the background of this particular tradition. And in a sense, in Burma, where this particular branch of meditation kind of has its origins from, the Vipassana practice is considered to be the cream of Buddhist practice, kind of the pinnacle of what they have to offer in that tradition. And even though it's quite easy to kind of, in a sense, to give the instructions and get a basic sense of it, and many people come here to Palo Alto and get introduced as pretty, hopefully pretty straightforward. And in Burma, people would actually maybe do many years of practice, other things, before they would do mindfulness practice. They might, for example, do many years of practicing their ethics, their behavior, kind of refining and purifying their ethical behavior. They might spend many, many years maybe practicing generosity. And if you're Burmese growing up in Burma, you do a lot of this growing up just as a child, but you're kind of laying down the foundation, the background. And you might do many, quite a bit of other kinds of meditation practices besides the mindfulness. You might do loving kindness meditation or various kinds of concentration meditations to kind of stabilize and concentrate the mind before you kind of open the mind up to mindfulness, which sometimes mindfulness can be a little bit agitating to people because the mind is now open to whatever is occurring in the present moment. And when the present moment isn't always so easy to be present for, and sometimes when the mind is open to whatever might happen, unusual things bubble up. If the mind is focused on a particular theme, like getting concentrated on the breath and nothing else, sometimes that can put a damper on other phenomena occurring. And it can actually be quite pleasant. A lot of bliss can arise, but not much wisdom or not much understanding arises in the process. So it's often said that in Burma, that person needs to be prepared before they do the mindfulness practice. And then finally, when someone does do it, they often do it on retreat. The meditation monastery where I practiced in Burma was kind of the headquarter monastery or headquarter meditation center for about 300 branch meditation centers all over Burma, maybe more. And it was kind of like a junior college campus built in the 1950s, if you can imagine something like that. That's kind of the feel of the place. It had these long, big kind of walkways and dormitories and meditation halls instead of classrooms. And during the spring vacation break, where whole families would come there to do meditation, there were, at one point in springtime when I was there, 5,000 people meditating at the same time as me. Can you imagine? It's one place. It's phenomenal. And one of the most powerful meditation sites of my life was regularly in the morning I would walk on a single file with some of the other men into the dining hall. And we'd have to walk by the woman's meditation hall, which was by far the biggest meditation hall in the complex. And Burma being a hot country, there's two sides of this women's meditation hall were big doors, that just a series of doors that were almost always just completely open. And so you can kind of see right through. And there were 500 women in this room meditating. And the women in Burma, in Southeast Asia, will sit with a lot more dignity than the men. I don't know why it is. I think maybe because this posture is considered to be not, you know, it's like women who are supposed to not sit on a horse, right? They're supposed to sit with both legs on the side to be womanly or whatever. So maybe it's just this posture for women was considered not quite appropriate. I'm not sure why. But so women would sit, in Burma, they would sit this way. If you can see, but the one foot would be behind them. And they're actually sitting flat on the ground. And sometimes they take their ankle or their foot, and you can bring it around and end up sitting on it. So you get a little bit of height, which is kind of nice, kind of up a little bit. And it's not just this is the way women would meditate. If you listen to Dharma talk in Burma, then you would always, men also would sit this way. So I sat in many Dharma talks in Burma sitting this way. I get used to it after a while. It's kind of nice. But this posture kind of makes you sit more upright, I think. Whereas the men, they would sit cross-legged and flat on the ground. They didn't have any cushion. They don't use cushions, so they just sit flat on the ground. And the men in Burma would meditate like this. And the women would meditate like this. A very different feel from looking at them. And so you'd go through this, walk by this women's meditation hall every morning. And there'd be 500 women sometimes in there in very neat rows, one row after the other. And to see these 500 women sitting there with tremendous strength and dignity and very intent with their eyes closed was so inspiring for me, this powerhouse of meditation. So it was kind of like a powerhouse, this place, this junior college campus. And many people would come there, families would come there, and children would come there. It was fairly common, especially during that spring break, that children would come and get ordained as novice monks for a week or two. And they would shave their heads and they put on their Buddhist robes. And they would line up according to age, I guess, or height, because they'd have the smallest in the front row, in the front of the line. And you'd see that as they got older, they're steadily getting taller and taller and taller, you know, be 100 or 200 of them in a row. And I always wondered what the effect on the children were to become ordained as novices, because Burmese culture has a very strict patriarchal family structure idea. So, especially the fathers, you know, rule is very absolute, and the children are very subservient to the adults. However, when a child is ordained temporarily, usually temporarily for a week or two, as a novice, men in this social system of these countries, they have higher status than their parents. Much higher, because they're putting on Buddhist monks. And so as soon as these children are ordained, the parents would get on their knees and bow to them, full bows to the ground. And they, you know, the kids would be up into little platforms and kind of like treated like royalty. So for 1 week or 2 weeks of their life, you know, of their childhood, they'd be like this, you know, they could do no wrong. You know, they're just like so reverent and respected, and their parents would kind of do anything for them. And I suppose at the end of the 2 weeks, they go home and things had to go back to the way it was. But I wonder what the effect of those children to have that experience, that there was something inside of them or some way they could be that warranted that level of respect from the people around them. So that was a long way of saying that this practice was originally designed as a retreat practice. And when this practice first came to America, it was primarily also a retreat practice. Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield mostly went around the country teaching retreats. And then by the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, it became clear that there was a great, this kind of almost schizophrenic feeling among many people who are meditating in our tradition of Buddhism. They were great yogis. Someone who goes on meditation retreats in our tradition are called yogis, because that's what they're called in Burma, so we just kind of adopted that. So they'd be great yogis, great meditators on retreat, and they get very concentrated and very blissful, and all these wonderful things would happen. And then they'd go home, or they'd go back from the retreat to the regular life, and they'd just be a mess. And everything would fall apart, and they'd just be miserable, and they just couldn't wait to be on retreat again. And there's kind of this retreat junkies. And they had no idea that practice was something, spiritual practice was something you did in your daily life. Real spiritual practice only happens on retreat. And so then there was a real divide in their life between the spiritual life and the non-spiritual life. So by the mid-80s, that became very clear that this was going on. And so then our tradition then began emphasizing the importance of sitting every day and practicing in daily life. And more sitting groups got started, like the one we have here, and a support for people to practice in daily life. And now in some circles in our kind of wider network of Vipassana practitioners in the West, there are some people who get introduced to the practice in sitting group like this, maybe sit every day and very interested in applying it to their life and how they live their lives. And it never occurs to them that they should go and retreat. Or maybe it occurs to them, but they would never follow through on that occurrence. It just doesn't seem to be very prominent in their mind. This is something valuable to do. I think the combination of going on retreats occasionally and sitting every day and practicing daily life provides a wonderful, they complement each other in very important ways. It's as if the intensity of the retreat experience provides a lot of depth to the practice, and the everyday practice in daily life brings the width of the practice. And you need to have both the width and the depth to have a mature spiritual practice. I love retreats. I probably am consistently much more happy there than any other time in my life. It's just a wonderful delight to be on them. However, retreats are also can be extremely challenging. And probably some of the most challenging things I've done in my life has been on retreat. The first retreat that I signed up for, some 25 years ago, it was actually a Zen retreat, a Zen sesshin for 7 days. And about, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 days before the retreat started, I called up the Zen center and said, "Something important has come up and I can't come." I didn't tell them that the important thing that came up was fear. And so I chickened out on my first retreat. So, you know, it can be kind of intimidating, these retreats. So maybe it's useful to tell you a little bit what goes on at a retreat. They can be one-day retreats, they can be weekend retreats, 10-day retreats, 1 month, 4 week retreats, 6 week retreats, 3 month retreats. More than 3 months, there's no organized retreats in our tradition, as far as I know. There's a 3 month retreat at IMS in Massachusetts. And some people will sit longer, but then it's not organized. Usually they go to Asia, for example. And in Asia, you just go to the monastery and you start and you stop when you stop. So my longest retreat was 8 months in Burma. And these retreats are silent retreats. So for 8 months, I basically didn't speak to anyone. Most days I had an interview with a teacher that lasted about 10 minutes. And most days I went for a Dharma talk. And sometimes there was opportunity for questions afterwards. But aside from that, I didn't speak, you know, just. And I had a little room, little monastic cell. And I would stay there and just do my meditation there on the bed and do my walking meditation during the daytime in a little hallway in front of my room. And then at night, when the mosquitoes came out, I would do it, my walking meditation inside the room, back and forth. So 8 months like that, without any real social contact with anyone. One-day retreats can be a little bit variable what happens. Some of them can be silent the whole day. And some of them around here, you know, one-day sittings, there's often a lot of instructions. If you go to one of Jack Kornfield's one-day sittings, like maybe some of you went last Saturday when he did it, I think Jack talks a lot. during his one-day sittings. Have you done a one-day sitting with him, anyone recently? No one here has done a one-day sitting with Jack Kornfield? I think he talks a lot. So a lot of instructions and a lot of, you know, inspirational talking. And so there's a wide range of what can happen in a one-day retreat. As you get into longer retreats, they become more, I don't know if it's the right word, but more generic and more common, more similar. So that's what I'll describe. The longer retreats are silent retreats, so that you, unless there's some rare situations where you have to talk, you would keep silence the whole time. You might occasionally talk. You have an interview with a teacher, so you talk there, and perhaps you have some kind of chore you have to do every day. Like if you work in the kitchen, then the cooks might tell you this is the way you cut the vegetables, or we need 5 gallons of onions, and so you start. And so they tell you just a little bit, and they say, well, what? You ask them what kind of cut do you need for the onions, and so they tell you, oh, they want, you know, wedge cuts and the onions, and so. So there's some communication, right? So in case you don't get out of practice. But basically, you're silent the whole time. Now, that for some people is a phenomenal challenge. Just to spend 2 days in silence. Some people, when they show up on these retreats and they have to be silent for 2 days or 3 days or 10 days, it's such a shock, both psychologically to anything they've ever conceived of before, but also almost to the physiological system. We're so habituated to talking and orienting ourselves to the world through our speech, that when you don't have that as an avenue anymore, people can be disoriented. And I've known people who said that, you know, they've had to run out of the retreat, you know, after 2 or 3 days to, you know, find some place in the woods or in the forest where they can just scream at the top of their lungs because the pressure was so big, because, you know, there's such tremendous addiction or momentum to speaking in our culture among us that it's such a strange thing. Also, on these retreats, there's a tendency for people not to make eye contact. Some retreats, that's actually the guideline, don't make eye contact. And so you're not talking to someone, and you're not making eye contact, you keep your eyes down, kind of. In normal society, that kind of behavior usually is communicating something, that something is wrong. You know, if people are constantly avoiding you, keeping their eyes down and not talking to you, or if you're always having to keep your eyes down, you know, usually we keep our eyes down when we're ashamed, you know. So for some people, this kind of behavior of keeping silence and not making contact with people is quite disturbing to them. And it could be a big challenge. It takes a while sometimes to get used to it. I've known lots of people who, after they got used to it, couldn't get enough of it, thought it was one of the best things, you know. Or they kind of struggled the first days of a 10-day retreat, and this is crazy, you know. It's inhumane, not talking. And then by the time they get to the last day of the 10-day retreat, they dread the fact that they have to speak in a few hours. They're gonna ring the bell and we can talk to each other. And they go, no, you know, don't ring the bell. I don't have to leave until, you know, half an hour later, you know, or whatever. Let's drag it out as long as we can. It's so precious to spend that time in silence. The interesting thing happens interpersonally is that there's a kind of a communication that happens without speaking that can happen on these silent retreats. If you sit next to someone on the retreat and you don't talk to them for 10 days, you get to know something about that person that you probably wouldn't have learned about if you had spent 10 days talking to them. You get to learn something about how they deal with challenges, how they deal with joy, how they carry themselves, kind of some of their deeper attitudes that get revealed. And there's a sense of, often by the end of 10 days, a sense of connectedness to the people around you that can be very deep. And sometimes the people at the end of a retreat will feel a tremendous sense of community and kind of like camaraderie. You know, they went through some great, great, wonderful adventure together and lived to tell it, talk about it. And so this wonderful feeling of connection can happen even without speaking. So people who are novices to this kind of experience can't imagine that happens. But once you kind of done it a few times, you know that's what happens. So the retreats are done in silence. They are considered to be intensive retreats, which means that the day is devoted to meditation the whole time. Usually we get up early in the morning, and how early can vary from retreat to retreat. Some retreats, the wake-up can be 5 o'clock. In our tradition, we usually don't wake up earlier than 5. If you're that, you have to go to the Zen tradition. And but sometimes a little bit later. If the shorter the retreat, the later the wake up usually. The longer the retreat, the earlier the wake up bell. And there's usually one period of meditation in the morning, and then there's breakfast, and then after breakfast, there's usually a kind of a long break, because part of that break is used for a work period. Because on these retreats that we teach, here in America at least, because there's no big staff to take care of all our needs, everyone has a little chore every day. Some people work in the kitchen, some people clean the bathrooms, some people, you know, sweep the floors or whatever. In Burma, they're very careful to protect the yogis from any kind of work, because they really want your experience to be totally intensive, and nothing kind of get kind of they kind of break up your the continuity of meditation. So in Burma, when I was there, I had no work at all, and it was a phenomenal experience to feel that I was recipient. No one ever asked me for any money either when I was there. It was just 8 months of generosity sustained me from other people. Tremendous act of generosity from the Burmese people to support me so I can stay engaged intensely on retreat. When my so I was sitting there in Burma after about 4 or 5 months, very quietly minding my own business, not causing any trouble, not doing anything very exciting, just sitting and meditating, you know, not, you know, how much trouble can you get into just sitting there quietly, the eyes closed. And suddenly I felt my filling fall in my mouth. maybe because, you know, the temperature varies, some it gets quite hot, maybe somehow the teeth expanded, I don't know what, but. And so anyway, so that, you know, the filling fell out. So the next interview I told my teacher, oh, by the way, the filling fell out. And the next day, a dentist from the dental schools came to the monastery to look at my teeth, because they didn't want me to leave the monastery, because then I had to, you know, break up my meditation for too long. So there was tremendous support there in Burma. So I just left alone to meditate. And is it okay if you go on these stories? So, I mean, I'm kind of diverging into personal stories. I have nothing to do with much of anything, but kind of travel logs. But maybe it gives you a little bit of sense of some of the possible ways. So I in Burma, I worked with a very strict teacher. He was, you know, one of the strictest teachers in the Burmese tradition that I know of. He would not only was strict, but he was kind of fierce. He would just, you know, raise his eyebrow and students would wither. You know, and so, you know, how's your meditation? And you'd tell him something and he'd raise his eyebrow and you knew that, you know, you better go back and start over again. You know, out of character, what most people think about our scene is very kind and friendly. And he was, you know, he was kind of tough compassion, I guess. And so he was very tough. And he required you, when you showed up every day for the meditation interview, to start the interview by telling him how many hours in the last 24 hours you had done walking meditation and how many hours you'd done sitting meditation. It's the first thing you had to say. So, and you couldn't lie, because meditators can't lie. So you would show up and you'd say, well, in the last 24 hours, I meditated, I sat for 9 hours, and I walked for 7 hours. And that was enough to get by, you know. You didn't want to do necessarily much less than that. But you're always kind of trying to get the most amount of meditation in there, so you reported, you can, you know, report you had a big number. And but every seventh day was his day off. So so every seventh day, I would do my laundry, because I knew that day I wouldn't have to report my hours, because it was only the last 24 hours. So that was the day I was okay, because I had to, you know. But how I'd wash my laundry was this way. Before I left Bangkok, I bought a big bucket, plastic bucket. So I had my own bucket. And I had, before I left America, I bought an electric coil. You know, these things you plug in the outlets, and this little coil, you heat up tea. So I wanted to do the least amount of stuff that would take me away from the intensive meditation. So I'd get up from my sitting, and very mindfully I'd go over and pick up the bucket, and I'd take it to the sink, and I'd fill it up, I'd put it down, and I would put the coil, plug the coil in the wall, and drop it into the water. And then I go back and meditate for another hour, or whenever long. And then I get up from my meditation, and I go over and take my dirty clothes, and I take a coil out, I stuff it into the hot water, and then I go back and meditate for another hour. And then after my hour's meditation, I get up, and I'll take the clothes out and put them on the line, and then I go back and meditate. So it wasn't like a lot of time I spent doing laundry, because I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to keep it to a minimum. So this, some of you must think this is really weird. Maybe I shouldn't have started off with these kinds of stories. I remember at So these retreats are so here in America we have yogi jobs. We have little chores to make it work, and there's a variety of things people do. And then there's and then after those are done, usually 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning, meditation schedule begins again, and it's an alternating schedule of sitting and walking. And so there's a period of usually here in America usually 45 minutes of sitting and 45 minutes of walking. And so you do that, you sit for 45 minutes, and then you walk for 45 minutes, and then you get to do it again, and then you get to do it again. So pretty soon you get the hang of it. And then you have lunch, which is the big entertainment of the day. And then you have a little break after lunch, and then you start it again. Sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking. And then you have what we used to call tea, because in the Burmese tradition, you're not supposed to really eat after 12 o'clock at all. You're supposed to just have light tea or something to drink. But here in America, we kind of extended that to just be just a very light snack. Like in the early years, it was rice crackers and sesame butter, and maybe an apple or something. And slowly, if you go to Spirit Rock, you know, it's slowly gotten more and more. Now they call it a light supper, because, you know, more and more. The main meal is lunch. And then after the light supper, there's a sitting, and then there's a Dharma talk, and then maybe a walking meditation and a sitting, and then go to bed. And that's the day. It's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. And it's designed to kind of keep the amount of distractions and activities to a minimum so you can be left alone the most. Part of the value of these retreats is that we learn to leave ourselves alone. Normally in daily life, we don't leave ourselves alone very much. We're distracted a lot. We do many activities. We get involved in our busyness. Something happens, and we don't really stay with what goes on, our feelings, our emotions, our thoughts, for very long, because we get distracted. Telephone rings, we go to work, or something happens. But there in the retreat, you're designed so you're really left alone. So you really can see yourself and be with yourself as you are, without any props from the outside, without any support from the outside telling you who you are, or who you should be, or what you should be doing, or how you should be reacting, or what you should be saying. You're left alone to find out who you are, kind of, and you're totally left alone, without any, you know, of the normal things there. Most societies that I know of, most religious cultures I know of, have something like some kind of way in which people will step out of the normal social roles for a period of time. Not everyone takes that option, but there's that option there. In the Native American tradition, you know, there's the vision quest. People go off and spend time in the wilderness. They leave behind their jobs, their family, their social roles, their professional roles. Everything gets left behind. In order to find out something about themselves when they're not being, when those parts of themselves are put to rest, the 40 days in the desert. In the Buddhist tradition, the same thing is to go on retreats. And have the retreats be as simple as possible so you discover who you are in a very, very raw, kind of basic, fundamental kind of level of who you are. And so that's why they're so simple and why we try not to do very much and why we keep the silence. Keeping silence, once we get comfortable with it, tends to free up a lot of energy. It tends to heal us a lot, because the way we speak often fragments us. When we speak, many people are very concerned about how the other people, what they think about them, and how we present ourselves, and how we are, what our opinions are, and all these things. There's a lot of extra stuff that goes on to speech. It has to do with our psychology and our self-image and all that. And when all that gets drops away, you have a chance to see ourselves or be present for ourselves in a radically different way than we're used to. Some people will go on retreats in order to unwind, to de-stress. And I think most kind of people who've never been on retreat, who hear, if you tell them, I'm going on a retreat, they think, well, you're probably going someplace like Club Med, Club Meditation or something. And, it's going to be really comfortable. They're probably going to have a jacuzzi and a sauna and a masseuse, and you're just going to hang out and, just be blissed out the whole time. And certainly, retreats are a place to unwind and de-stress. But it's not really the primary function of them. And if that's the only motivation a person comes on retreat, the retreat will only go so far. It might do that to some degree, but it actually will kind of dead end at some point. So the retreats certainly have that aspect. They can be very relaxing. The other thing is, retreats tend to reveal much of things in our life which are hidden. It's quite common in many of our lives not really to notice very deeply what's going on, not really to pay attention to our deeper feelings, our emotions, our attitudes, our responses, our fears, and to live a life that's kind of, maybe outwardly directed. And there's can be often be a tremendous amount of stuff which is buried inside of us. And part of the function of retreat is to give us a chance to that stuff to bubble up, to reveal what's really going on with us, what really motivates us. And I've known lots of people who have come to interviews on retreat and kind of with big wide eyes and said, I had no idea how pervasive fear was in my life or some other thing. I had no idea how much I was addicted to desire and pleasure. I had no idea how judgmental I always am. Because our judgments, our fears, our addictions and desires, we're kind of caught up in the middle of them. We don't necessarily see them. They get interrupted for a moment. But in retreat, there's a way in which, because we're not interrupted, because we're left so alone, the common patterns, the way our mind works, gets revealed very, very clearly. Sometimes painfully so. So much so that some people will say, self-knowledge is never good news. Now, that's not true, but it can feel that way sometimes. And then you might say, well, why should you go on retreat? If it's not good news, if you see, well, fear is pervasive in my life, why would you bother going on retreat to discover that? I mean, you can go to a real Club Med, And the reason is that the things that are buried inside of us, things we don't know, can still be motivating our behavior, motivating our attitudes and reactions to life. And if we don't really face them directly, then they're still running the show kind of in a subconscious way. We're kind of ignorant of them. And it's more, Buddhists say that it's much more useful to bring those into the light than it is to push them back into the dark. And some people will kind of run away from certain things they discover because it's maybe too challenging. But what we train ourselves to do is to go back into that, bring light to those difficulties, if that's what's going on. So in that case, a lot of retreat experience for some people can be learning how to be accepting of oneself, how to be compassionate towards oneself, how to have kindness towards oneself, when a lot of difficult stuff begins to bubble up. So retreats help people unwind. Retreats help people discover what's hidden inside of them. Retreats also are a phenomenally useful way of developing our concentration, our mindfulness. Mindfulness is it can be developed kind of like a muscle gets developed. Concentration can be developed like you develop a muscle. So you're going to the meditation gym, Club Med, after all, and the continuity of practice builds that inner psychic or mental muscle. The more you practice mindfulness, the more you practice concentration, generally the more ability for concentration you'll develop. And so one of the places to develop your mindful concentration is by doing it all day. Now, one of the things that you're taught on these retreats, especially after the fourth or fifth day of a longer retreat, is you're instructed to make the day seamless. And seamless means that there's no, you don't take a break. Well, you can take a break. I mean, in terms of, you know, you don't have to always be doing formal sitting meditation or formal walking meditation. But during your break, you're supposed to stay mindful. You can kind of hang out and lounge and have tea or something. But you're supposed to stay present, not let the mind kind of wander off into its fantasies or ideas or whatever. But just kind of stay present, tracking what's going on in the present moment all the time. The meals are meant to be meditation periods. So often people start slowing down how quickly they eat. They sometimes eat very, very slow. I've known people that have taken an hour and a half to eat lunch, sometimes longer. I remember one friend of mine who took an hour and a half to eat lunch complained feeling being felt rushed by other people. So there's the eating of eating mindful. The idea is to keep it seamless so that from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to sleep, you're cultivating presence in the present moment. You're developing that and strengthening that ability. And it kind of builds momentum. It's kind of like the continuity of practice builds the strength of it. If you interrupt the continuity, then you backslide a little bit. And when you start up again, you have to kind of build up the momentum again. So this fierce teacher I had in Burma, he had high expectations for us in terms of continuity. And you might have had the world's greatest meditation one day. You're excited to go and report to him, this great thing happened in my sitting meditation today. And you're ready to tell him all about your sitting meditation. And he would look at you and say, "When you came in through the door just now, what did you notice?" "What do you mean, what did I notice?" He said, "Come back tomorrow." Because we had to be accountable for every moment. We had to be every moment. Or, he didn't do this to me, from friends of mine. This is what he did to me one day. I was going to tell him some great thing that happened to me, right? Excited to tell him. And he looked at me and he said, when you get up from your sitting, I sat in the bed, so when you get down from your bed to do the walking meditation, what do you note? Because most people, when they finish their meditation, just jump up and go to their walking and then start again. But we're supposed to, there's no end to the meditation in this tradition, right? You're supposed to, there's formal sitting meditation stops, but then you do getting up meditation. And so I had to say, what did you notice? And, I mumbled something and he kind of, "Come back tomorrow." but what about my meditation? So the idea was to have continuity throughout the day. Now that also can seem somewhat oppressive to people, the idea that you're always engaged like that. However, it's a wonderfully liberating. It's a wonderful feeling when you start realizing that ability to stay present is really where there's a tremendous joy and liberation, ease and peacefulness that's available in that place. And that when you really get into it, you feel that anything that takes you out of that is actually stressful. It's actually when you really settle in the present moment to start thinking about, work or whatever, or even to have a conversation to someone is actually quite, compared to kind of the peace of just being really present and resting in the present, it's actually somewhat stressful. So rather than being oppressed by the idea of always doing a seamless practice, it becomes kind of a refuge or a delight. So in Burma, I did this 8-month retreat where I mostly didn't talk to anyone for 8 months. But after about 5 months there, I forget what happened. Something happened. And, how should I forget? There wasn't so much that happened. So something happened, and so I decided that I would take a little break from 4 months of just practicing all the time. So I was going to take a little break for maybe half an hour and clean my room. It hadn't been cleaned in all these times, so I was sweeping and stuff. And there was this American monk who was there who was kind of talkative, And he noticed that I wasn't intent on my meditation anymore, that I was cleaning my room. So he came over to talk to me. So I talked with him for half an hour. This was the first long conversation I had. I finished the half an hour conversation, and I had to go take a nap for 2 hours. It was so exhausting to have this conversation. So retreats unwind people. They help them to reveal what's hidden, buried. Sometimes quite difficult material, sometimes wonderful material. They also help develop the strength of mindfulness and concentration. And some people will find that going on retreat gives a big boost to their meditation practice. Certainly boosts it in terms of inspiration. And they come back often from retreat kind of really inspired and feeling, okay, and I'm really going to do it now, and they're going to sit every day. There's a lot of strength that kind of carries them out of the retreat into the daily life for a long time. And some people will find that going on retreat, then coming back from daily retreat, their daily sitting kind of drops to a whole different level of experience. About the revealing, how retreats reveal our experience. Spiritual life entails an intention or aspiration. Maybe I should use the word aspiration since they both have the word breath in them, spiritual and aspiration. Our spiritual aspiration, no matter what it is, our spiritual aspiration can be, maybe this is not a very good choice of words, but just, you listen, take me lightly. But our aspiration can be pure or impure. And most of the time our aspirations are mixed. Very few people have complete purity or complete impurity. But our aspiration or our intention can be a little bit off. So, however, if you sit every day, you might not notice that. So, for example, someone might think that spiritual practice is really, all it really is about getting calm. They might think so. So every day they think, well, that's really what's going to happen. If I get calm, then I'm a spiritual person, and so they sit every day, and they get some modicum of calm every day, and they can watch. Every day they meditate, they get a little bit calm. Wow, I'm really a spiritual person. This is great. And I'm really doing good, and me and the Buddha, we're kind of like, pretty good, chums here. And you really think that you're really doing something good. And you are. I'm not going to knock it. But then you go on retreat, and your intention is basically just to get calm. And after a day or two, you get a little bit of calm. And then, if that's all your intention is to get calm, you'll get to a place where you're not going to get any calm anymore, any calmer. But that's your intention is to get calm. And so you keep trying to get calm, but you can't, because you can't get any calmer than you are what you are. So then you keep trying, and you get frustrated, and wait a minute. I can't seem to get any calmer, and so... But that was the whole point of doing my meditation, was to get calmer, and I can't get any calmer, and what am I doing here, and this is pointless, and maybe I should be a Club Med, and then you come up against this wall, and you go, wait a minute, and if you're really honest, you ask yourself, well, if I'm not, if maybe I have to let go of this intention to be calm, this aspiration, is there another aspiration I can have, is there another intention that I can have? So was that clear enough? So I just use that as an example. There's many examples. I mean, each of you have your own. But the intention with which we sit and practice, our spiritual intention, gets refined and clarified very dramatically on retreat. It's kind of like putting it in the oven, letting it bake, and really see what kind of bread you've made. But if you sit every day, you never get to see that. You might actually congratulate yourself for things which have no real meaning. So I don't want to frighten you away from retreats, but I hope that's not what I've done here today. So when I did my early Zen retreats, which are in some sense much tougher than the kind of retreats we do in Vipassana, in our tradition we err on the side of being really gentle with ourselves. In the Zen tradition, they err on the side of being disciplined and hard, tough. So one of the rules when I sat my early retreats in Zen, was that you weren't allowed to move once you sat down to meditate for the 40 minutes, you couldn't move. So you had to sit completely still. And my body was not acclimatized to this posture at that time. And so I had a tremendous amount of body pain. And I couldn't move, you know. Probably I couldn't move, but I was too stupid to know it. Or I just, you know, that's what they told me to do, so I just didn't move. And I would get up. In Zen, they would sit for 40 minutes, and they have 10 minutes of walking meditation, and they'd sit for 40 minutes. I'd get up from the 40 minutes of sitting, and my whole body would shake because of the pain. And it took me 10 minutes to calm my body down so my body would be still. And then I'd do it again. So you might think it's stupid. It might have been, but anyway, I'm not going to either justify or criticize that, but that's my experience. What I'm saying this is that so I had a lot of physical pain. And the physical pain burned up my intentions. All the ideals I had about what spiritual life was like, all the wonderful, grandiose plans I had for what I was going to do when I became fully enlightened, what it meant, and what I, you know, all the ideas of great, blissful love and union with the cosmos or whatever, all the various ideas I had what spirituality was all about, none of it made any sense. None of it could stand up in the context of this tremendous physical pain. And then, but I stay in this place. And what is left? Who am I when everything's been taken away from me because of this pain? And so much excessive stuff got burned up in this process that it was very, very helpful for me. So retreats aren't always like that. I mean, that kind of pain. However, just simply being on retreat and engaging in our best effort day after day tends to reveal our intentions and clarify and purify and refine them to become purer and purer. The last thing that retreats can do is that they can reveal a potential inside of us which maybe you never knew you had. A potential for peace, a potential for love, potential for courage, a potential for concentration, a potential for freedom, for awakening. And I suppose that in daily life, normal life, there's a lot of situations where you might kind of touch on these potentials inside of us, and those seeds get awakened and shown this is possible for human beings to have these experiences. However, in my life, I think retreats are the kind of preeminent place where it's kind of designed to help create the conditions to help foster this most easily. You go in other situations in life, it's not so necessarily so easy to discover this very deep potential, spiritual potentials we have within inside of us. And even in other situations, if some of those things might be touched into by accident or by inspiration, love and great peace, so often they're outside of meditation, sometimes they're stimulated by something in the world around us. You know, if you win the lottery, you know, it's easy to be happy, perhaps for a few days at least. If someone comes and someone is tremendously loving, comes and just offers you lots of love and gives you unconditioned love and thinks you're the greatest, it can melt your heart and you can feel real joy and love, and it's really easy. So there's a lot of, or you can go into nature, and nature can do tremendously wonderful things and really feel great peace and sense of well-being in nature and connectedness, whatever. However, it's still coming from outside in a sense. What the meditation retreat does is to help you discover that possibility inside of yourself, unprompted by anything, unsupported by anything, unconditioned by anything. There's no conditions in the world that you depend on to have those feelings of love or peace. So the ultimate goal of Buddhist practice is to discover unconditioned happiness or unconditioned liberation or peace. That which doesn't depend on any conditions for its presence. And so that's why I think that the retreats are very, very powerful, because they're so simple, so radically simple, these retreats, that you have this chance to discover something inside that you could say is always there, but never really seen or appreciated, which is unconditioned, doesn't depend on anything. And once you know that you have something inside of you that doesn't depend on any of the conditions of the world, then it's possible to have a much lighter attitude towards the conditions of the world, to be much more gracious about them. So they come and they go, and you're not, all your eggs are not in the basket of the conditioned phenomena of the world. You lose your job, you get a job. You lose a relationship, you get a relationship. You stay in health, you lose your health. All those are called conditions of the world. And those conditions of the world come and go. But to discover this kind of that, you don't have to put all your eggs in that basket, but discover you have this wonderful egg inside of you which is not dependent on anything, gives you a very different relationship to the world around you. When I was this is maybe kind of anticlimactic, but when I was in Burma, since I'm kind of telling Burma stories, you know, on the American dollar bills, it doesn't say like "In God We Trust," and there's this pyramid, right, which is like this maybe symbol of real stability and strength. And banks in our country are these institutions of stability. You look at a bank, facade of a bank, right, and there's this great stability. And you can trust banks, right? They're always going to be there. And there's, you know, and the dollar bill, you can always trust the dollar bill. If you have it, at least, you can trust it, right? It's a solid, good stuff. So, you know, I thought, you know, money is money, you know. It's like, you know, nothing can be more stable than money if you have it. And so here I was meditating peacefully, you know, and I knew I was going to go on this intensive retreat. I wasn't going to leave the monastery for many months. So my first day in Burma, I went to the black market and changed a whole bunch of money into their local money. And I didn't have actually that much money, but I changed some money and I had it there just in case I needed it for any reason. And then one day I woke up, or one day we went, I don't know, I found out that over that night, the Burmese government had decided that all the bills were worthless. They weren't going to honor them anymore. I mean, a lot of people in Burma didn't trust the banks. They had the money under, you know, their money in their mattresses under their, you know, under the mattresses. And you wake up one morning and you're told your money is worthless. You know, tough. You know, so anyway, you can't trust things. You know, we put a lot of trust into things which maybe ultimately are not that trustable. And what meditation teaches is it shows you where you can find a peace or equanimity which is not dependent on the things which are variable. Oh, and then the last story I'll tell. Going on longer retreats is useful because of this reason. You go to the first day of the retreat, and you're very tense when you get to the retreat. You've been working hard and busy. And the first day of the retreat, you kind of, just naturally, because you're not so busy, you're quiet, not talking, you begin to unwind. You relax, your shoulders relax, your stomach relax, your breathing gets more comfortable. You feel more kind of harmonious throughout your body. And you congratulate yourself and say, "Oh, I'm a great meditator. I can really do this. You know, I should tell my friends about this. This is really great." You're not a good meditator. You're just unwinding. But anyway, you give yourself credit. And then the next day comes along and you've unwound as much as you're going to unwind, and you think you're still in charge, so you're going to barrel ahead and do your intention, and you can't get any more concentrated. In fact, you're getting less concentrated, and you get really frustrated and say, "This is terrible. Why am I here? And I can't wait until it's over, and this is terrible, you know, I can't seem to manage, and who are these teachers? They don't know what they're talking about." And so, but you stay for the third day. And the third day, you just drop down and you feel all this joy. Oh, joy, joy. Oh, wow. I can't wait. You know, everybody should be a meditator. It should be the world religion. Wow. And then the fourth day comes along, or the fifth day, I forget where I'm at now, but the next day comes along, and now there's burning back pain. And you know you have no back problem. As soon as you get up from the meditation, pain has gone away. And you know, what is this pain? You know, you have good posture, you have good health, and used to just burning pain. And well, this must mean you have cancer, and it's never going to go away. And you start planning that trip to the doctor. And the next day happens, and the next day, all this peace—the peace that you never tasted before. And the next day, you're restless. And the next day, you finally catch on what's going on. And what you catch on is things are always changing. And then you then it becomes much more gracious about it. Oh, things are changing. The normal tendency for us is to grab onto whatever's happening in the moment and hold on to or come to great conclusions about it. And to realize things are always changing gives a certain amount of grace and ease with all these changing things. So then when you come back to the next retreat, you might have the same pattern, but you're much more easy about it. Oh, you're tired the first day, you're restless the second day, or whatever. Or you feel peace one day, and oh, this is nice to feel peace, you can appreciate it, but you don't, you know, start making plans about your great enlightened retirement. So I believe that these retreats are some of the most profound and powerful things that people can do in their lives. I've had a lot of people who have come to me and said things like, that 10-day retreat was more effective than 2 years of therapy. I've had a therapist sit in on my interviews when I'm on the retreat. Usually there's one-on-one interviews on the retreat. And our tradition is usually every other day. And usually it lasts for 15 minutes. So I give these interviews. And I had this therapist who was being trained to be a Vipassana teacher. I was sitting in just to kind of learn what happens in interviews and kind of as an apprentice. And after we had a series of maybe 5, 6, 7 of these interviews, one after the other, on the second or third day of the retreat, she turned to me when no one else was in the room, and she looked at me in amazement, and she said, that's amazing. As a therapist, it takes me 6 months of seeing people once a week before they're that open with me. And you never met these people before in your life. And they come in 15 minutes, they come and they're so open, they're so undefended, so willing to kind of put everything out there, what's going on. Retreats are phenomenally powerful. They tend to bring out the best in people, their best intentions, the best, the best parts of who people are. And they tend to become very, very honest, very direct, very undefended. So certainly I get to see that part of people. It's a real privilege as a teacher. But also, we get to see ourselves in that kind of role because of that great openness that happens, the great undefended state. It is a phenomenal privilege for me to be a teacher on these retreats. I think, I'm the one, people think they're going to the teacher, the great teacher, whatever, for interview or whatever. And it's almost like reverse, because where in your life you get to sit in the room on a chair, and maybe I have 10, 12 people come in one after the other, and each of those 12 people are coming basically to be completely honest and truthful and talk about something that's phenomenally deep and important in their life. I mean, to have that clarity and that honesty and that openness and directness, I feel like they're the teacher for me. I feel so inspired. I feel such a privilege to meet that kind of honesty and that kind of sincerity, one after the other. Retreats are not difficult, but they're, I think, among the most rewarding things that a person can do. So that was my thoughts. I'm sorry I talked so much. I hope that this was useful. And those of you who are disturbed by this talk, then I think you should go on retreat. So thank you very much. Next week, we'll celebrate the solstice here.